Well, good morning and Happy New Year to you. If I haven't met you yet, my name is Kevin Carruthers, South Campus Pastor, and it has been a joy and a privilege for the past year. My wife and I have been down at South Campus, and we've been getting to know the people there. We're excited about what God is doing there and looking forward to some new and exciting plans for 2024. For those of you who are joining us online, welcome as well. And those who are at Bearspaw, Bridgeland, Airdrie, and of course, my favorite campus, South Campus, which will be kind of weird for them today because I won't be there in person, but I'll be there on the screen. But that's okay. A couple of weeks ago, in continuing in our theme through in December about peace, Pastor Ashwin spoke out of Micah chapter 5. And he talked about the idea of the promise of peace. And as I was thinking about that and kind of thinking about the message on peace today, my mind went back to last summer where my wife and I had the opportunity of going to Washington, D.C. and walking for a number of days up and down the National Mall. Have any of you been and done that? Been there? Hands? Yeah, some? Okay, that's good. It's a day full of walking and reading. And for whatever reason, I love reading things and I retain all of these obscure facts in my head, which is a bone of contention for my wife because I can't remember what we talked about last night. But it was an exciting time, and you know what was interesting was that it was filled with memorials of war and monuments of peace. And one of the things that I had read there from the New York Times in 2003 was this. Of the previous 3,400 years, humans have been entirely at peace for only 268 of them. That's just 8% of the time. And there have been 8,000 peace accords signed and broken. Now, that should come as no surprise to us, the idea that we need peace, that we long for peace, that it seems to be something that sort of eludes us at times. Because let me ask you this, how was your Christmas? Right, we talk about the Prince of Peace, and yet sometimes those Christmas gatherings can be anything but that. We had the opportunity of being up in Edmonton for Christmas with our in-laws, of which I'm considered an outlaw, and so we desperately need peace in those gatherings, as joy-filled as they are. It's an opportunity for us to kind of dive into some understanding of how the Bible looks at peace, and there's all kinds of illustrations and verses that we couldn't possibly cover just in two messages. So today I'm going to be looking at Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 through 10, and I want to encourage you to follow along and even read along with me off the words off the screen. Isaiah chapter 11, beginning at verse 1. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. The justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, and their young will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. Let's pray. Father, as we come today in a world that we live in that's anything but peaceful, and I'm sure in a room this size, relationships, some of which are strained, families that are at odds with one another, neighbors that we need to be repairing relationships with, colleagues at work that we're kind of struggling to see eye to eye with, I pray that there would be some new and fresh understanding that you would give us through your word, Jesus, through the example you give us in this text, in the prophetic word of the messianic coming King, and Holy Spirit, as you work in our hearts and minds to help us not just to be hearers of the word, but to be doers as well. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Isaiah is an Old Testament prophetic book that often prophesies about the great messianic king that's going to be coming and to be born into the world through the line of Jesse and David. Because as Christ followers, we believe that this messianic king is Jesus, at Christmas, we often look at these kinds of passages. We kind of look back into the Old Testament to get sort of a deeper, richer, fuller understanding of who Jesus is as he was prophesied to come in Isaiah some 700 years before he showed up in Bethlehem. I mean, one very familiar verse we've already heard during this Christmas season out of Isaiah 9, verse 6 is, "For unto us a child is born, and a son is given. The government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." The Prince of Peace. The themes of Christmas, I believe, if applied to our lives, will absolutely transform us. These verses are telling us about a coming messianic king that's going to be born and the peace that he's going to bring. And there's three characteristics that I want to sort of draw out of the text today about this coming king, this person that we know of as Jesus. We're going to look at his justice, his wisdom, and his identity. First off, the Messiah's justice. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 4, the beginning says, But with the righteousness, he will judge the needy. With justice, he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. Now, what it sounds like is that he's going to be judging the needy, that he's somehow going to be condemning them. And that's not what these words actually mean. It's sometimes tough to translate things into English for us to understand. What it really means is that he will make things just for the needy. In other words, he will put things right. He will make the crooked path straight for them. When it says that he will give decisions for the poor of the earth, the word poor means downtrodden or exploited, people without power. And to say that he will give decisions for them actually means that he's going to stand in their place. He's going to advocate for them and exercise his power. He's the great equalizer. He's going to identify with the poor and give decisions on their behalf and use his power to make things right again for them. Now, at this point, it sounds like we're going to see and experience some kind of a kind, benevolent leader, doesn't it? A king who will come and bring peace and create social justice, and it sounds good. And then we sort of get to verses 6 through 9, and it sort of blows the doors off of everything. And it says in those verses that the wolf is going to live with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling will be together. A little child will lead them. A cow will feed with the bear. The young will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like the ox, and an infant will play near the cobra's den. The young child will put its hand in the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all of my holy mountain. Now, this imagery, these pictures that we're reading in Isaiah here, are saying that this is not just about a Messiah or a king that's going to be coming to make this world a little bit better, to sort of do a little bit of a renovation on what we've got going on down here. What he's saying is this, that he's going to get rid of death, that he's going to get rid of disease and violence and suffering, and he's going to make everything right. And he's going to bring peace, and he's going to restore things to the way that God initially and fully intended it in the Garden of Eden. Now, how many of us would enjoy that kind of an experience of peace? How many of us desire that kind of peace? And that is a bit of a foreshadowing of what's going to come when Jesus comes back again and restores the entire world and earth to a new heaven and new earth. But in the meantime, he also comes. Imagine if he can do that. Imagine what he can do in your family. Imagine what he can do in that broken friendship. Imagine what he can do with that relationship that right now you already have a name in your mind that you know is strained. Jesus is able to bring peace into those kinds of contexts as well. And the Christmas story sheds light on this. We're told that this king is going to care about the poor and identify with the poor, but it's not until Bethlehem that we discover the lengths to which the messianic Messiah does this. Because it's at the Christmas story that we hear that the Son of God, the creator of the universe, was born into a poor family. That's how he was going to identify. We look at his parents. When they went to the temple to have him circumcised, they gave two birds as a sacrifice. back in those days, the sacrifice that you brought to the temple was dependent on your income. They couldn't afford a goat. They couldn't afford a lamb, let alone an ox. All that they were able to put together was two small birds because of how poor they were. Look at his priorities. Jesus didn't just come when he began his ministry to preach the gospel, but rather as he ministered, he served. He fed the poor, he healed the sick, he raised the dead, he exorcised people of demons. What does this mean for us? What it means is that, among other things, that this has to be our priority too, that not only do we need to be concerned about the poor, but that we can't do it from a distance. And we notice this in Jesus' life and ministry. We notice the proximity that he has with people. He didn't commute in from the suburbs to help the poor. The moment that things maybe started going well for him, he didn't flee out of that poor neighborhood that he grew up in. But rather, he participated with people where they were at. And in some respectful, loving way, we as a church need to come alongside and get involved with the poor. It's one of the reasons why Center for the City was established. And last week, we heard some real exciting news and numbers about how that is ministering and working and bringing hope and peace into the lives of people who need our help. There's over 300 people who come every week to experience a meal at the cafe, who come in to get warm, but not just to get warm, to understand what it means to be served by people who love them, to have a conversation, to not look down on them. There's over 500 food hampers that were distributed over Christmas time here to families that needed our help, that needed more than just something physical. They received something physical, but they also received the love of Jesus and the hope and peace that he can bring to them. One of my favorite Christmas verses is out of John chapter 1, verse 14. And it says this: "So the Word became human," Jesus, right, the pre-existing Son of God, "became human and made his home among us. He was full of unfailing love and faithfulness, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son." I love the way the Message paraphrases it when it says, "The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood." He had proximity with the people that he was serving. And it was an example for all of us, even as individuals and as families, how we need to personally be patterning our lives after Jesus, the coming Messiah, the one who demonstrated justice in everything that he did and said and advocated on behalf of other people. Christmas points us in that direction. That's the Messiah's justice. But secondly, we see another characteristic of the coming Messiah in Isaiah 11, and that's the Messiah's wisdom. And this is a really important theme as well, and one that's very applicable to all of us. In Isaiah chapter 11, verse 2, we read, "The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might." And that word counsel also means wisdom. So alongside the might is the counsel. I think sometimes we might be able to kind of do one or the other, but we have a tough time balancing both, right? It's easy to bring might to a conversation. It's easy to bring that to the family meeting around the table, right? But what about wisdom? What about the way that Jesus married the sort of the idea of truth and grace? And so we have this picture here that not only does he have the power to do what needs to be done, he knows exactly what needs to be done. He knows the best way to get it done, and he has the authority and the power to do that. But we continue on in verse 3, and this is where it gets really intriguing. It says, he will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. Now, let me ask you a question. When you think back to some of the dumbest decisions that you have ever made in your life, some of the foolish things that you've done, almost always it's because that you acted impulsively on something you saw or something you heard. Not so with the coming Messiah. He's not going to work that way. He's not going to operate that way. It says here that he's not going to judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. It's important for us to understand that there are things that we do that are judged that way. That's the way that we respond at times. It looked good. They look good. She looked good. He looked good. Everything's going to be fine. What's the worst that can happen? And yet we don't operate or have the wisdom or maturity to discern the consequences or the implications of following through on these impulsive decisions. But not so with the coming Messiah. That's not how he's going to work. The wisdom of Jesus, the wisdom of God, is one of the major themes of Christmas as well. Because when you look at the Christmas passages, one of the things that's always a part of the Christmas story are the wise men. They journey. They come. They bow down. They bring gifts. Now, let me just pause for a moment as an aside and ask you this question. How many of you have a manger scene set up in your home? Manger scene, right? Manger scene, all right? I would like to know how many of you have that set up accurately. Because as my kids grew up, when we had a manger scene set up in the living room, you know where the wise men were? In the family room. And if we had a manger scene set up in the family room, you know where the wise men were? In the kitchen. Because if you go to Matthew chapter 2:11, you'll understand that the wise men were not at the manger scene, right? But they were part of the story. They were part of the journey. They were part of the expression of how God was revealing himself to the people of the world. It was almost 2 years later when the wise men showed up. And it's intriguing. It's a picture. It's a picture of this idea of the Messiah's wisdom, that the wisdom of the world cannot hold a candle to the wisdom of God, that the wisdom of the world bows down to the wisdom of God and the way that God does things. And especially in Jesus' plan of salvation and the way that God saved us through Jesus, which begins at Christmas time. God's thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. And at Christmas in particular, in fact, most of Jesus' ministry, we see a contrast between God's wisdom and the wisdom of the world. Everything that Jesus does turns the wisdom of the world upside down. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul writes these words. He says, "The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are headed for destruction, but to those who are being saved, we know it is the very power of God. Since God in his wisdom saw to it that the world would never know him through human wisdom, he has used our foolish preaching to save those who believe." So when we preach that Christ was crucified, the Jews are offended and the Gentiles say it's nonsense. Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. This foolish plan of God is wiser than the wisest of human plans, and God's weakness is stronger than the greatest of human strength. A couple of examples, I think, are fleshed out through the Christmas story here of the wisdom of the coming Messiah that was prophesied 700 years before he came. First, I want to look at the idea of the method of Christmas, on how Jesus actually comes into the world, of how completely opposite it would have been to the world's way of doing things. My wife and I, one of the reasons we were in Washington is that we have a pilgrimage that we do every summertime. We make our way through and try to get to all of the Major League Baseball stadiums. We've done 21 or 22, so we're getting close. And I remember very clearly being in San Diego in Petco Field on a Sunday. If you know anything about San Diego, and if you know anything about a baseball game on a Sunday, every Sunday game is dedicated to the military because there's a military base there. And it is first rate. We got there early so we could see it. And they have the coming in of all the colors of the different military. The flags are there. They sing. No one sings a national anthem like Americans at a baseball game. And they're singing with gusto. And then there's this flyover, and it's deafening, and it's, you know, you got goosebumps going up and down. And then by the seventh inning, when we have the seventh inning stretch, the pilots of those planes that had done the flyover are brought onto the field, and 42,000 people in standing ovation are cheering for them and singing, "God bless America." Now, if you were the Son of God coming into the world, isn't that how it should be done? Like, wouldn't you do it that way? Doesn't it make sense that because this is such a significant happening and fulfillment of prophecy, that it would even look something like this? But not so. Not so with God. He didn't do it that way at all. Manure smell. Feed trough. Stable. Poor parents. Let me expand on that thought of how this wisdom of God seemed foolish to the people of the world. How does strategic planning work? Well, if you've been a part of it, you get people together and you get a dream board and you put at the top of it your preferred future or your vision or what it is that you're actually shooting for and wanting to achieve. Once you've identified that, you go through this process of talking together and brainstorming how we're going to get there. Now, let's imagine for a moment that you've got a group of people together and you say you're going to have a strategic planning meeting. And you say, I really want to be successful in life and I want you to help me get there. That one of the first things they should ask you is, well, what's the vision? What are we shooting for? So we can talk about how we're going to get there. What if in that strategic planning meeting I said, I want to be so successful that 2,000 years from now, virtually everyone in the world knows my name. That in 2,000 years, I'd like 1 billion people in the world to center their lives on me. That I would like my teaching to be seen as the single most important thought in human history and for it to be a perpetual bestseller. And I would like the history of the world divided around the date of my coming. That sounds pretty successful, doesn't it? That sounds like pie in the sky that would never possibly happen. But we're in a strategic planning meeting, and so they would say, how are we going to accomplish that? What if people started saying, well, make sure you're born and you spend your entire life in a town that's out of the way. Don't have a career in any major urban place or cosmopolitan city. Make sure you don't have any networks in economy, political, social, academic influence. Make sure you don't have any contacts in those networks. And then finally, just as your career is taking off and gaining traction, be killed in one of the most shameful ways possible. Do you think anybody would say that at that meeting? That was on God's strategic plan board. Because the wisdom of God makes the wisdom of the world look foolish. And the wisdom of the world, for them, the wisdom of God looks foolish. God went about it in a completely different way. It was the opposite of the world's wisdom and the idea of success. In fact, it would seem that Jesus did it all the wrong way. And yet the message of Christmas is also speaking to the wisdom of God. The story of Christmas is that Jesus Christ, the Messiah, was born into the world. The pre-existing Son of God was born of a virgin birth. It was miraculous. It was supernatural. You know, whenever the wisdom of our world is kind of putting things out there for us to consider and hopefully in their mind buy into, it's often, in some ways, tries to make Christianity look dumb. About 100 years ago or so, there was this divide that was beginning in Christian churches and institutions because people started saying this, that the world was telling us that everything has a scientific explanation, everything has a natural cause, that miracles can't happen, the supernatural can't happen. Because the world was telling us that, we're going to have to change our Christian faith if we're going to actually survive at all. You see, the problem that we have, though, is this book. This book is filled with miracles in the Old and the New Testament. And yet if we were going to buy into the wisdom of the world, we were going to have to somehow extract from the Bible just the moral and ethical principles that everyone can accept, that the world could accept. Love one another. Work for social justice. All people are created in the image of God. We can live with those things, but we can't believe in a pre-existing deity or Jesus born of a virgin birth, or a bodily resurrection, or an infallible, inspired Bible. And certainly we don't believe that everyone needs to be miraculously saved through the power of the Holy Spirit. And the division was great. Somehow that if pressure was on, that if we didn't conform to what the world was saying, they're going to laugh at us. They're not going to respect us. No intelligent person is going to follow the Christian faith unless you get rid of the supernatural. But here's the interesting thing about the message of Christmas. Those churches and institutions that embrace the wisdom of the world are all in decline. And yet the Christian faith is growing like crazy in places in the world that no one could ever imagine because it's a supernatural faith. It's a miraculous story that we have at Christmas time. In about 100 years, Africa went from 5% Christian to 50% Christian. Korea, very similar. It went from 0 to 40% Christian in about the same time period. And some of the things that we're hearing, and we're only getting little snippets of what's going on in the persecution of the church in China. But the reason why that's happening is because the church in China is growing exponentially, because it's a supernatural faith that we embrace. The Jesus that we follow and serve is a Jesus of miracles. It's a Jesus beyond the understanding of our world. The message of Christmas is that God has broken in through the barrier of between earth and heaven and invaded our time and space. And now there's hope and mercy and peace and grace. And that changes everything. The world has often said that we're wise and you're foolish, but in the end, the wisdom of the world is shown to be foolish. Our world develops new paradigms all the time, and they'll try to get us to sort of buy into it or to dumb things down to kind of be a part of what's going on. In Romans chapter 12, verse 2, it says, "Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing what? By changing the way that you think. Because the way that you think affects how you behave." A couple of other paraphrases of that passage, and one in the Message says, "Don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God. You'll be changed from the inside out." I love the imagery in the J.B. Phillips paraphrase, which says this: "Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its mold, but let God remold your mind from within." The Christian faith will continue to grow because it's characterized by the wonderful foolishness of God. And our responsibility is to align ourselves with God's wisdom, with the wisdom that was being talked about right here in chapter 11 of Isaiah, of the coming Messiah King. That he'd be different than the world that he was moving into. That it would go beyond any of the understanding that people around him had. That it would look foolish to the people who didn't embrace who he was. The Christian faith will continue to grow and we'll begin to see that God's wisdom is, in fact, the wisdom of all, which we see in particular clearly focused in the manger. There was glory in the manger, but few people saw it. Finally, there not only is the justice of the Messiah and his wisdom as well, but we see his identity here. Who is this king? I mean, if we just sort of read through Isaiah 11 and didn't have the understanding of the New Testament, we'd need to sort of understand who are they talking about? Who is this Messiah that's being prophesied about in the book of Isaiah? In verse 1, we read this: "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse." Now, that's sort of a biological or a botanical description. A shoot that comes up out of a stump or a branch that comes out of a tree means that you've descended from someone. That you've come out of somebody. What it's saying is that this messianic king will come out of the tribe of Jesse, who is the father of David, a physical descendant of King David, which is why it was so important for Matthew and for Luke to be able to put these genealogies or these family trees in their gospels, to be able to demonstrate that Jesus, in fact, did fulfill this prophecy in Isaiah, that he was connected to Jesse, that he was a descendant of King David. But if you go down to verse 10 in Isaiah 11, you'll probably read this without noticing the implication. Maybe you've already seen this before. But it doesn't say that this Messiah is only this shoot of Jesse, but it also says that he's the root of Jesse. Verse 10 says, "In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the people. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious." Now, wait a minute. Isn't your root something that you sort of are growing out of? And here it's saying that Jesse and David have come out of the Messiah. How can someone be both a shoot and a root for Jesse and David? How can someone be both a descendant and the source of Jesse and David? It's part of the miracle story of Christmas. It's part of the miracle of the coming Messiah. The answer is that the Creator God, who is the root and source of all of us, was born into the world as a human being, and he became a physical descendant of King David and his father Jesse. He's the God-man. This is the miracle of the Christmas story. And it's important for us to understand that because it's what separates the Christian faith from all other religions. The world basically understands sort of two kinds of religions. There's many others, but two kinds. One is the religion of performance, a religion where God's law is there. Maybe it's the Ten Commandments, and if you're good, God will bless you and take you to heaven if you're good enough. But if you're bad, there'll be wrath and judgment on you, and our world understands that kind of religion. It's simple. It's black and white. There's good people, and we try to be one of them. There's bad people. We don't like them, but God's going to judge them anyway. And when we get to heaven, we're going to get these scales up there and all my good deeds on one side and my bad on the other. And what I'm really hoping is it goes like this. And I get in. Haven't thought about what's going to happen if it goes like this. But the other kind of religion that the world particularly today has is this. And that's this religion of permissiveness, a complete acceptance. The view that sees God as a spirit of love in the world, like a loving, docile grandfather figure. And you have to decide what's right and wrong for you. You shouldn't tell anybody else what their choices are for right and wrong, because basically we have a God of love that just universally accepts everybody. Everybody's included. Everything is acceptable. Everyone is loved. The world understands this kind of religion as well, a religion of performance or a religion of permissiveness. But the Christmas story is about the Christian faith that it's neither of those things. Both of those religions basically are religions of me, religions that are about you and do. In both cases, you make the decisions. You decide what's right and wrong for you. You work it out. It's up to you to be good. It's up to you to decide how to live your life, which way you need to go. In both cases, it's that you're on your own doing your own thing. And it's what separates, as I said earlier, all other religions to the Christian faith. Two words, do and done. The permissive religion and the religion of performance are about do. Do, do, do. You, you, you. Everything you could do to earn your way to heaven, to impress God, to validate why you're here, do. The Christian faith is about what's been done for us, what Jesus came to do. What this coming Messiah King in Isaiah chapter 11 was prophesied to be about. Not just justice, not just wisdom, but his identity was going to be one to come and just completely transform everything in our world if we embraced who he was. The Christian faith is infinitely richer and more multifaceted. And how do we know this? Well, the one born in a manger is not just human, and he's not just divine. He's both. He's both. And what this means is this, is that he's not just one more religious teacher or one more prophet or holy man come to tell you how to find God. No, he's God come to find you. He's God come to find me, reaching out to us. He also comes, and yes, he fulfills the law, but he's God come to die because of his great love for us. The meaning of Christmas ultimately is rooted in Easter. Jesus ultimately came at Christmas time to die on my behalf at Easter time. It's not a religion of performance or a religion of permissiveness. It's a relationship of grace. And grace is costly love. And yes, there's going to be wrath and judgment. There's going to be consequences. There's a penalty for our sin. We aren't living the way that we should. And Romans 3:23 says it that way. It says that all of us have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. All of us have sinned and have missed the mark. We're not living up to God's standard. We've done some terrible things. There's selfishness and pride in our own hearts. And every one of us has done things where we deserve to be condemned. Therefore, there is wrath and consequence for our sin. But, on the other hand, God comes into the world, born in a manger, goes to the cross himself, and takes the punishment that I deserve, that we deserve, and he satisfies his own wrath. That's another miracle. Now, why not look at costly love and grace rather than performance and permissiveness? God's love satisfying the penalty of my sinfulness. Imagine that. Imagine how foolish that looks if we don't believe who he is. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. I was blind, but now I see. I may not be able to explain everything in the Bible. You may not have all the answers for the people that you're in contact with in your circle of influence, people at the gym, people in your neighborhood, people in your family. You may not be able to explain virgin birth. You may not even yourself understand some of the things that are written in the Bible. But you've got a story like I do. You were once blind, and now you see because of what Jesus has done. Because the Messiah prophesied in Isaiah chapter 11 has come and fulfilled that prophecy. And when I experience that, it changes everything. It changes me from the inside out, that he would love me like that. On the one hand, it convicts me not just to live my life any way I want anymore. On the other hand, it frees me. There's no pressure on me to have to perform, to have to live up to some standard I couldn't possibly do, to try to meet a penalty I couldn't possibly pay. This is a faith for everyone. That's the reason it's spreading the way it is. That's the reason why Christianity is growing in places around the world like we've never seen before. My prayer is that we'd see it here. That we'd see it here. This is the wonderful foolishness of God. So what are you basing your life on? What are you hoping is going to help you face the inevitable suffering you're going to have in life and eventually death? What are you hoping is going to give you self-esteem and a feeling of self-worth? What is it? Is it power? Is it position, a new job, better benefits? Is it prosperity, earning more, making more, spending more? Is it a person you haven't met yet that somehow is going to change and transform your life? What is it you're hoping? What is it you're hoping is going to happen to get you through these things? If it's anything other than Jesus, if it's anything other than the promised and delivered Messiah who is risen from the dead, you're basing your life on the wisdom of the world. What I can tell you is what you're basing your life on is going to desert you. It's going to disappoint you along the way, and in the end, it'll ultimately lead to defeat and finally death. But Christmas means the justice, the wisdom, and the identity of God has been revealed. He's come to do something that you can't do for yourself. He's come to miraculously break into your world and offers you the opportunity to embrace that. And when you do, you'll experience his peace like you never have before. But when you do, to some of your friends, to some of your colleagues, to some of your family, you may look like a fool. But the wisdom of God trumps the wisdom of our world every time. So as we close, what is God saying to you? What's he saying through the book of Isaiah? What's he saying through his Spirit that's speaking to you right now? Maybe it's something he's been speaking to you about all through the Christmas season. Maybe even before that. It's one thing to identify that because we believe God is speaking and he's here today doing that. But to take that to the next step, the second question we always ask is this: what's he asking you to do about it? How is your life going to be different? What change are you going to make? What change is he just asking you to make? Because all he ever asks us to do is to take the next step of obedience. The next step. Let's take a moment and just think about what God is asking us to do and what he's saying to us. And then we'll close in one final song.